This podcast is brought to you by Berry Brothers and Rudd, sponsors of Great Conversation.
Welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman. On the morning of the 24th of June, Britain woke to find its stock market shattered and its pound pummeled. It appeared, for a brief moment, like all the prophecies of the Brexit doomsayers, not least the great seer Osborne, had come true. But then, from the wreckage of that midsummer morning, green shoots began to appear, and now, more than 2 months down the line, it seems that Britain has bounced back. In his cover piece this week, Ross Clark argues that the Remain campaign fell victim to the perils of believing their opinion to be objective fact, and that economic recovery has humiliated the Treasury, Bank of England, and the other grand institutions who swore that Brexit would leave us poorer. So is he right? Or is it too early to truly evaluate Britain's new place in the world? Well, I'm joined now by Ross Clark and Torsten Bell, director of the Resolution Foundation. So, Ross, you're very upbeat in your piece in this week's magazine, but isn't it just a little bit too early to be this cheerful?
Well, there are lots of things that could go wrong. We haven't actually left the EU yet, of course. There could be a trade war, but my money would not be on a trade war because it would hurt the rest of the EU as much as it would do us. But, I mean, what really sort of gets me is the way that before the referendum, it was not so presented as an opinion of the Remain campaign that the economy would tank. It was presented as fact. It was presented to say, you know, so many economists believe that things will turn down that they cannot be wrong. This is absolute objective truth. And Nicola Horlick on Monday morning on the Today programme was still trying to say, you know, all these economists can't possibly be wrong, in spite of the obvious and growing evidence that they have been wrong. And there was initially, the markets fell sharply, the pound fell, and was probably only to be expected given that the negativity that existed at the time became a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. But within a week, the markets had started to tell a different story.
And this isn't just a return to a normal service, this is a real bounce.
The FTSE 100, the FTSE 250 are both higher than they were before the referendum. And I suppose, you know, there's an argument to say markets don't like uncertainty, that they were actually suppressed before the referendum. And whatever the result, they would have probably gone up. You know, they would probably now be higher than they were.
And Torsten Bell, is this not just that Remain made so many dire predictions during the referendum that everything just by default seems much better because we're expecting a sort of zombie apocalypse by this point?
Well, it's definitely true that everything in life is relative to your expectations or to the person you're standing next to. There's something in that. In general, I think claims of apocalypse on the basis of one bit of data and claims of bounce or boom time Britain are probably both equally wrong. The truth is we don't know, and we won't know for some time what the actual impact of Brexit is. Actually knowing, even at any stage, knowing exactly what the effect of Brexit is will be very hard due to us having no counterfactuals about what would have happened otherwise. But look, what the underlying economics here, and the reason why Ross and others obviously don't like that when people were saying there were simple facts that said exactly what would happen the day after the referendum if they got the wrong result, it's because people are mixing up the long-term effects of a changed trade relationship with the short-term demand effects of a shock to the economy. What is definitely true about the Remain campaign is that for understandable political reasons, the long-term effects and the short-term scary shocks were mixed up into being one thing. And what is, in general, economics is more certain about what are the long-term effects of trade changes and much less certain about what specific demand shocks, how they work their way out, what happens to consumers, what happens to businesses, which is what we're now seeing over the summer, which is consumers and businesses reacting very differently and then reacting to each other. And that's what will determine the short-term effect. But in general, we should all calm down a bit and we should all probably stop claiming that any single bit of data says very much indeed.
But it's all part of the Remainers' case that all the long-term effects will be negative. They work on this assumption that there will be less trade in the future if we leave the EU. does a case for saying things go in the opposite direction. We are now allowed, for the first time in 45 years, to make our own trade deals with countries outside the EU, whether it be Australia, well, China, don't know that yet, Japan.
That may or may not be true. So that depends. Well, David Davis's position, as he said, on the House of Commons on Monday, would mean that if we've properly left the common customs area, that we could negotiate trade deals, and then Liam Fox would have the benefit of having a job, yeah. And so that would be good for him, and maybe good for our trade with Australia and other things. Obviously, his assertion that we'll definitely wish to leave the single market has been knocked down by number 10 since then, and if we don't leave the single market, it's far less clear that we'll be able to negotiate our own trade deal. So that goes again into the let's wait and see
category.
Well,
this assumption, isn't there, that the EU has been good for opening up trade with the rest of the world. Actually, the EU has underperformed horribly when it comes to negotiating trade deals with China, Japan and so on. Switzerland has managed to do that, but the EU hasn't managed to do that.
But Ross, we've had this week Barack Obama reiterating the warning that he made during the campaign that Britain would be at the back of the queue for trade negotiations with the US. Or Australia have been more upbeat but have said you'll have to wait until we've done our negotiations with the EU as well. So other countries, even if the EU isn't very good at these negotiations, other countries do still seem to prioritise the EU because it's a large bloc. Is that a false assumption too?
Well, look at the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. It's on the point of collapse. So what's the point of being at the front of the queue if they can't actually deliver the deal? Barack Obama, of course, is only going to be there till January anyway, and his successor will almost certainly take a different view.
I think we should be clear about what Barack Obama is actually saying. He's saying two things. That mean, I don't think, he didn't repeat back of the queue, I hope.
No, he didn't use that
good,
language.
That's a very sensible, it's just a bit rude apart from anything else. But there's two things going on. There is, it's hard for us to negotiate with you until you know what your relationship is with the EU because of this issue about are you still in the single market with a Commons Customs Union, in which case I can't negotiate with you full stop. There's no point in me starting negotiating with you until I know whether you're in or out. Now, that is fact. That's like a reasonable statement. There's then a separate issue, which is a political view, which is it more important for me to finish my trade negotiations with other people before I get round to discussing with you? Now, that's a kind of swings and roundabouts. You can obviously employ more trade negotiators.
Well, exactly. This is assumption you can't do too.
That's true, but it is a political choice. He happens to be the president now. Someone else will be the president in... Sam, we'll see what they say, as you say. But on the first bit, which I think is a factual statement, which is what can people properly negotiate with us prior to us being able to tell them honestly whether we're in or out of the single market? Not a lot.
At the moment, markets obviously don't like uncertainty, but at the moment they don't have anything to react to because we don't know what Brexit means. David Davis helpfully said Brexit means leaving the European Union, but then did give us his own definition of Brexit, which was that it would be improbable that we could retain single market membership whilst controlling immigration, which was then slapped down by number 10. So when we eventually do get a model, which seems to be something the government doesn't really know anything about either, is there one model which would actually cause more of a Brexit bounce than another?
Cause a Brexit bounce. I'm trying to avoid the words bounce or catastrophe on the basis that none of us know. In some ways, the weird thing is, David Davis and the Remainers have the same position. That's what's odd here. Like, and in some ways, maybe David Davis feels like he's being honest. His position is, you can't control immigration and have the single market, and therefore you should junk the single market. The Remainers' position is, you can't have both, and therefore you shouldn't have left the EU in the first place because you can't have what you want. You can't have your cake and eat it. And Theresa May, at the moment, quite understandably, they would like to have a bit of the cake and a bit of the eating it with the migration and the...
But that's not possible, is it? Is it?
Not possible. I mean, look, the world's a complicated beast. Let's see what happens. What is definitely true is that, is it a simple case of going to the EU and saying, I would like single market access like I have now, particularly for the service sector, but I want total control of my borders. Is that an easy negotiation? No, we have no evidence that is an easy negotiation, and so this cake and eating it plan is difficult. Is it unreasonable of her to try that in the first instance? It's not unreasonable. Let's see how she gets on.
Ross, what do you make of the way that ministers have been handling this so far? Individually, they all seem a little bit confused.
Yes, yeah. Well, I think that this week has not been the best week for David Davis being slapped down. We don't seem to hear a lot from Boris and Liam Fox. I don't know where he is. He seems to be missing. I think that...
Maybe it's his week for the country house.
Maybe. I think there needs to be some progress made pretty soon because I think the markets will get a bit nervous if there isn't a clear strategy for these negotiations emerging soon.
Do you have sympathy with ministers, given it is such a complex issue, or do you think they really should have made more progress over the summer in their thinking on this?
There is a problem, I think, of knowing where to start and whom do you go to? I mean, you know, it's just a sort of unprecedented thing to negotiate departure from the EU, virtually unprecedented. Greenland managed it. You know, over the autumn, presumably, they will get together and they will come up with a strategy and they will come up with a proposal which they will then put to the EU. And these few months, we've been told that, indicated that Article 50 won't be triggered until early next year. I think, you know, at that time, if we get to January, we've got a proposal in place to put to the EU before we trigger Article 50, then I think all will be well.
I think the way to think about this is the negotiation is like a return to a barter economy. So we're engaged in a negotiation where nobody knows, there is no set price for the things that are up for negotiation. And the reason set prices in general, when you walk into the shops, you don't haggle over the price for the goods because you kind of get that is the going rate and you kind of take it and it makes everything easier. You get it, you see that on house prices. People haggle around the margins of the what they think is the market rate rather than starting from scratch and guessing. Like, you don't have to be an expert in negotiation theory to know if there is no set price, these things are bloody hard because reasonable people don't have a shared sense of what they're trying to get to. And when we say, particularly as all ministers reasonably are saying, we don't want an off-the-shelf deal, what they're really saying is we don't like anything that's got an existing price tag on it, so could we have a discussion about something that isn't currently priced? And that is hard. All negotiations where that is the case is hard. Then on top of that is laid the fact that it's substantively hard. These are not simple issues, they are overlapping issues, and there are lots of interacting forces. So, you know, if by the end of the year we have a very clear, detailed view of what we're actually trying to negotiate, then I'll be pleasantly surprised.
I think there's a wider political issue here, and that is, to what extent is government going to be gummed up by this whole process of Brexit? And will the government be able to do anything else other than Brexit? Will it be able to deliver on manifesto? Will it be, or, you know, will the next 4 years sort of end up to be this sort of complete gummed up government business with nothing else happening? And I think that could be a political danger for Theresa May.
That was Ross Clark and Torsten Bell. And now, a word from our sponsors.
If you've ever wanted to start a wine cellar, 2016 is the perfect year to begin. Berry Brothers and Rudd's cellar plan is designed to suit every taste and budget. To find out more, visit bbr.com/cellar plan.
In his piece this week, Peter Oborne declares that we are witnessing the last few months of the Mugabe era in Zimbabwe. A full 2 years older than our own Queen Elizabeth, Mugabe has led his country for all of its 36-year history, but few nonagenarians are cut out for the rigours of governing an African nation. The country has empty coffers on a scale that even Liam Byrne wouldn't joke about, and is heading for an economic disaster and possible violence should Mugabe seek to cling to power. So will he head for the exit door before the 2018 elections? And if not, what does the future hold for the Zimbabwean people? I'm joined now by Peter Oborne. So Peter, what condition is Mugabe currently in? Is he really at death's door, as some media reports have suggested?
I think the Zimbabwe president is in really bad physical shape. He is said by local observers to have prostate cancer and also to have heart issues, and it is said when he walked around recently last week, he's got to the stage where he can't wear shoes anymore because of his feet are so swollen, they're sort of loose slippers, which is why there was sort of a great deal of credibility attached to the idea that he may have had a mid-air health incident at the end of last week.
Right, I see. And you talk about the last few months of the Mugabe era. Health aside, is that realistic, or is health such an influence that you think he could step aside very soon indeed, or that it's more realistic that he would try to keep going, sort of making the occasional public appearance and then step aside at the 2018 elections?
Well, it's worth saying that there have been endless health scares concerning the president of Zimbabwe, and they've all proved to be false. So he's not, but on the other hand, he's 92. He clearly, if you look, you need to look at him, he's in he's not in great nick. He's said to sleep through cabinet and so on now. I don't think he has the physical energy and the health to maintain himself as an effective executive president. What is clear, though, is that the economy has now gone into, in particular, the financial system is now in a state of galloping contraction. It's in it can't survive as a functioning economy at all now.
And this is worse than the 2008 crisis as well, is it?
Yeah, 2008 was desperate in Zimbabwe. First of all, you had the elections, which were won through really horrible violence. So there was a reign of terror in particularly in the country areas. But there was also a ferocious hyperinflation, which led, you know, on a Weimar scale, which led to the. But there was a solution to the hyperinflation, and that was dollarization. It has switched over to the US dollar, and because the MDC opposition did well, there was a coalition government, and of this genius finance minister, who really deserves to be celebrated, Tendai Biti. He brought in the dollar and brought in stable finances and put everything back on an even keel. And there was a remarkable economic recovery. We now advance to 2016. They've had that solution, but it's been thrown away by the ZANU-PF government since 2013. Chinamusa, the acquaintance of Peter Mandelson, is clearly not up to the job of managing the finances. And he's embarked on this desperate quest for cash dollars.
And just explain a little bit more about this relationship with Peter Mandelson, which you mentioned in your piece that Peter Mandelson turned up with the British ambassador. What was going on there?
Yeah, nobody really knows what was going on there. According to the British Foreign Office, Mr. Mandelson was merely there to help in a sort of general sense. I don't think it was appropriate that the British ambassador, Lady Ambassador, should have been with Lord Mandelson. He's too controversial a figure for that.
And in terms of what happens next, if Lord Mandelson can't save Zimbabwe, who can?
Right. So I think if Mugabe stays in place, we enter a dark black hole. Zimbabwe, we know, has been in crisis for 15 years, but I think it takes a new dimension downwards into something more like the Congo. The rule of law will collapse altogether. The economy will collapse. You will see the emergence of warlords and all the rest of it. So, and I think that the international community is aware of this. And what can we do? Well, what is interesting, what I gathered during my recent trip, is that Mnangagwa, Emmerson Mnangagwa, who is the vice president, is being favoured by the West. Well, and they see him as a man of business, which is not completely unrealistic. He's much less corrupt than quite a lot of ZANU-PF figures, and he is a pragmatic figure. There are elections in 2018. If we could have free and fair elections, then. The whole thing can turn on a sixpence. All that Zimbabwe is the most glorious country. It's got wonderful infrastructure. It's just beautiful. It's fantastically fertile. All it needs is good governance, integrity of government, and security of tenure, and it will just take off.
That was Peter Oborn. And finally, the name on everybody's lips this week has been Keith Vaz. Or should that be Jim, spelt J-I-M? The Labour MP for Leicester East was alleged by the Sunday Mirror to have been cavorting with Romanian rent boys, popping poppers and offering to cover the costs of cocaine. If this behaviour on its own weren't enough to land Vaz in hot water, he also happens to be chair of the Home Affairs Select Committee, which deals with thorny issues like prostitution and drugs. After a day spent acting like the world's most innocent washing machine salesman, Vaz finally resigned from his chairmanship on Tuesday afternoon. In his Spectator column this week, Toby Young theorises that Vaz is a psychopath, incapable of fear or guilt. He joins me now to defend that position. So, Toby, it's quite a strong hypothesis that Keith Vaz is a psychopath. Why do you think that?
Well, I suppose I'm deliberately being a bit provocative.
Never.
I was also comparing him to Anthony Weiner, the American politician who had to resign as a result of a sexting scandal in 2011, tried to relaunch his political career in 2013 as a mayoral candidate in New York City, and then had to and the campaign went up in flames when he was revealed to still be sexting women. And he's done it for a third time, and his wife Uma, who also works for Hillary Clinton, has now left him. That happened last month, and the documentary about Wiener came out earlier this year. And I was thinking about why it is that these senior public figures with quite a lot to lose do these extraordinarily stupid things, get caught, and then, you know, see their careers and in some cases even their lives ruined. And one theory about Wiener is that he is a narcissist, and in particular a high-functioning exhibitionist narcissist, which is a sort of newly discovered subtype.
Makes him sound like a trapeze artist.
Yeah, it's someone who suffers from the normal characteristics of narcissistic personality disorder. So they're highly competitive, highly sexed, have a sort of overweening self-regard, low empathy, and so forth. But they combine that with some characteristics which help them become successful. So they're very goal-orientated, they're quite energetic, often very articulate. And sort of, does Keith Vaz fall into that category? Well, not quite. One of the interesting things about the Keith Vaz scandal is that he thought that none of these rent boys that he was paying for sex, allegedly, would recognise him. So there's a sort of odd form of humility there, thinking that, you know, I suppose, or perhaps it was snobbery, thinking that because they were rent boys, they couldn't possibly kind of follow politics, and therefore he could pass as Jim the washing machine salesman amongst them. I recently read a paper by the late behavioural geneticist David Lycan about psychopathy, and he had this particular theory, which is that psychopaths suffer from a low fear quotient. So when they're children, it's quite difficult to instill a sense of right and wrong, because they don't have any fear of punishment if they behave badly. And that might explain both Wiener and Vaz's behaviour. If, like a normal person, they thought about the possible consequences of being caught for their behaviour, then they wouldn't do it. And in particular, they wouldn't do it a second and a third time in Anthony Wiener's case. So it could be that they just suffer from unusually low levels of fear and anxiety, which I think is actually, I was quite convinced that by Lycan's hypothesis that this was the kind of at the root of psychopathy. And also, Lycan talks about a talent for psychopathy. He's talked to a lot of clinicians who have taken people suffering from psychopathy through various forms of therapy, and one of their characteristics is what he calls this talent, which is the ability to repress any uncomfortable feelings when you anticipate the likely consequences of doing something wrong, or when you remember something wrong you've done. Unlike normal people, they don't suffer from a sort of sense of foreboding or any pangs of guilt or shame having done wrong. And that seemed to be true of both Wiener and Vaz as well.
So do you think it could be a problem that afflicts many more politicians? Politicians do seem to be characterised by strange risk-taking behaviour. That you described the tension between Keith Vaz, who was sort of known for having a reasonably high sense of self-esteem most of the time, thinking that the rent boys wouldn't recognise him and wouldn't see through his gym industrial washing machine persona.
I think not being fearful or anxious in the same way that a normal person would. And I think, you know, how anxious and fearful you are is probably on a spectrum. And people like Keith Vaz and Antti Wiener are outliers. But I think that can be a huge asset in politics. And one of the things that David Lycan says in his essay on this subject is that he thinks that Lyndon Johnson and Winston Churchill had kind of psychopathic personality types, and they were characterised by a kind of low fear quotient, which is the phrase he uses. Keith Vaz was a pretty fearless chair of the Home Affairs Select Committee.
Do you think he was also less fearful of exposure because the press, that the bar of interest, the threshold for public interest and also just finding the story interesting has got much higher than actually Stephen Crabbe, for instance, a number of texts that he'd sent to a woman about wanting to kiss her everywhere were a sort of minor story in the summer. And they did lead to him deciding to leave the cabinet in the end, but it wasn't a big scandal in the way it might have been, say, 10 years ago. So do you think that scandals are becoming less common, less interesting?
I think the press certainly feels under a greater obligation to make a watertight public interest defence before it can reveal a scandal like this. Certainly much more so than 10 years ago. I think perhaps the bar is falling slightly now that the threat of an independent press regulator created by Parliament is receding. One interesting dimension of the Keith Vaz scandal, I noticed that Dr. Evan Harris of Hacked Off questioned whether there was a genuine public interest defence here available to the Sunday Mirror. And, you know, that seemed to me extraordinary. I mean, how high does the bar, how high is the bar in Evan Harris's eyes? Because, you know, Keith Vaz, if these things are true, is guilty of breaking laws that he himself help to create. And you sort of get the impression that if Evan Harris had been around in the early 70s and a tabloid had broken the Watergate story, you know, he would have questioned whether there was a legitimate public interest defence there.
That was Toby Young. That's all for this week, and you can subscribe to this podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. If you enjoy the podcast, why not try out the magazine? Reward yourself this weekend and pick up a copy of the most provocative publication in Britain. We have a trial offer. Get 12 issues for just £12 by visiting spectator.co.uk/12. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.